The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone. The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you've been led to believe the Bible is nothing but a book of mythology. How can anyone take all those miracles seriously? Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, the parting of the Red Sea? I mean, come on, get real. In fact, even unicorns are mentioned in the Bible. You can't get more mythological than that. What's up with the unicorns? Are you troubled by the unicorns? Are the unicorns keeping you up at night? Don't worry. Your old pal Bob will navigate you through this. Something to look forward to later on in the program, because we don't shy away from controversy. And while we're on the subject of controversy, last week I spent a good deal of time talking about the tension between South Park and Mecca. The producers of South Park, you may recall, were warned on a Muslim website that their lives might be in danger for portraying Muhammad on their cartoon television show. Folks, we need to talk about this for a moment. Now, I realize that Muslims don't believe in having any kinds of drawings or pictures of Muhammad. And that's fine. I can respect that. That's part of their religion. They can believe whatever they want. So they don't have to make the drawings. But how can I put this delicately? That is their religion, not mine. Not necessarily yours. To the rest of us, Muhammad is a historical figure, not a prophet, and we are entitled to portray him any way we want in a country that's supposed to be based on freedom. I'm a Christian. Jesus was portrayed as a crucifix in urine a few years ago. Now, as a Christian, I found that disgusting. I would think any human being would find that disgusting, but I gotta tell you, the artist was not worried about his life. Actually, the South Park creators, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, haven't been too worried either. They cleverly satirized the inability to show Muhammad by having him appear in a bear outfit. Then the threat came. Then their network, Comedy Central, caved. On the following week's episode, Muhammad's name was mentioned only with bleeps, and his image was covered up by the word censored. Here's an audio example of the infamous episode.
You said you wanted we got him for you.
We have no way of knowing if is really in there. It could be a trick.
It's no trick, dude. My friend and I went to the Super Best Friends and brought him here.
Then have him step out of the bear costume. You have until the count of 10. One.
Don't do it, Randy. If is seen, we could get bombed.
Two.
Idiot, if he isn't seen, we're about to definitely get bombed.
Three.
All right, stop. We'll do what you say. I'm sorry, will you please step out of the bear costume?
Okay, so, see? That is a... That's Santa Claus.
Sorry, boys, I tried. Boys, you got Santa to be... When?
When you all said you were gonna hand over to Tom Cruise. We promised Jesus that would stay safely in the U-Haul.
In any event, last week I gave a passionate plea over the air to stop placating to militant Muslim threats. Not to say that bleeping something out is never appropriate. I do think we should quit cowering down to the Muslims, but how about other people groups like senators, for instance? One that quickly jumps to my mind is the friendly little exchange that took place a while ago between Barbara Boxer and General Michael Walsh when she questioned the general about unrepaired levees in New Orleans.
Well, why has it been delayed?
Ma'am, at the LACPR is...
Do me a favor. Could you say Senator instead of ma'am?
Yes,
it's just a thing. I worked so hard to get that title, so I'd appreciate it. Yes, thank you.
Yes, Senator.
I got to tell you, I find this awfully petty with all that's going on in the world right now between terrorist attacks and a collapsing economy and a government determined to transform us into a European redistribution colony. Barbara Boxer has nothing to worry about besides her own vain title. Well, don't you worry about it, Barbara, baby. Don't you worry your pretty little head about it. None of us here in California have forgotten that you are a senator. As a matter of fact, we plan to particularly remember this November when we go to the polls. And we're going to find the word senator in front of your name and then check the box for somebody else. Of course, General Walsh was gracious enough to honor her request. Well, he's a better man than I am, but one of our board ops here at KCBQ, Paul Drivas, was very moved by Senator Boxer's words. And between Paul's genius and the inspiration of Comedy Central, we now have a new version of this fun conversation.
Well, why has it been delayed?
Ma'am, at the LACPR is...
Do me a favor. Could you say... Instead of Senator.
Yes,
it's just a thing. I worked so hard to get that title, so I'd appreciate it. Yes, thank you.
Yes.
Well, people may be afraid to speak out against militant Islam, but they have no problem at all speaking out against those who want to obey the law. Like Cardinal Mahoney of Los Angeles, who has condemned the new Arizona immigration law, comparing it to, now hold on to your seats, because this is going to be a big surprise, he compares it to the Holocaust. Yeah, right. Everything gets compared to the Holocaust. As a Jewish Christian, as one who grew up as a Jew, learning about the real Holocaust, I am sick and tired of these ridiculously stupid comparisons. It waters down the sting and impact of what the true Holocaust really did. We aren't talking about Germans who were guilty of handing out citations for jaywalking, for crying out loud. Honestly, the Cardinal's irresponsible statement displays ignorance at the very least and exploitative cruelty at the very most. If Mahoney is aware of what went on in the real Holocaust, he should be ashamed of himself for making such a statement. It isn't as simple as saying, the Nazis asked people to show their papers, and so now the Arizona Police Department asks people to show their papers. See? We're just like the Nazis. Any American who has traveled out of the country or even across the state or even too quickly on the freeway and gotten pulled over has had to show their papers. A good name for it would be driver's license. Or in another country crossing the border, a good name for it would be passport. You remember those, don't you? Since when did such documentation become so controversial? When Germans looked at papers, folks, it was for the purpose of hauling people off to concentration camps for execution. Nothing even remotely similar is going on in Arizona. And to actually have to stop and explain that is such an understatement. It feels foolish and stupid to even have this conversation. But I have to have the conversation because these are the times we live in. If you want to take a political cheap shot, just compare the opposition to the Nazis. This tired show has had more performances than Phantom of the Opera. Hey, Mahoney, how about the 6 million Jews who were murdered? How about the gassings, which included women and children? How about the babies thrown alive into ovens? Into ovens. And you are comparing this to a policeman who asks for a driver's license or a green card? When our law has already said for years that guest workers have to carry a green card, have you no conscience, sir? And while we're on the subject, Mahoney, since you speak on behalf of your Catholic faith, the Vatican didn't have much to brag about while the authentic Holocaust was going on, did it? It often looked the other way when Hitler was in power. But if you honestly care, maybe you can speak against all the historical revision about Israel or that recent Muslim rally in Florida where a Muslim woman shouted, "Go back to the ovens, Jews." That might warrant a reaction, Cardinal, just in case real holocausts concern you. Not interested? Then maybe you should back off with the moralizing. And so, Cardinal, if you would care to offer an intelligent argument about immigration laws, do so. Just leave your Holocaust comparisons out in the pasture where they belong. Hey, Father, before taking your next confession, I was just curious, where do you go for your own confession? It seems some penance is in order. Now, I have nothing against Catholics, so don't bother calling in to say that you were offended. I do have a problem with religious hypocrisy and with somebody using his position as a cardinal to say damaging things. I will still defend his free speech under our Constitution, but so will I defend my own. And I just called it like I saw it. So much for Mahoney's comment about Arizonians who like their new law. What about those in Arizona protesting the law? The other Arizonians, how do they rank with other protests in the news lately? I mentioned last week that in addition to the mainstream media, politicians like Bill Clinton and Nancy Pelosi have expressed grave concern about Tea Party protests. It seems they are just waiting for violence to break out, even though so far the 1,000-plus tea parties around the country have been very peaceful. The same cannot be said of Arizona gatherings protesting the recently signed immigration law. At least 4 protesters have been arrested for throwing water bottles at police officers. Rocks have also been hurled, and a group of people assaulted a man who admitted he favored the new law. Be that as it may, our commentators seem unconcerned. Many outlets are not even reporting the violence, and the few who do talk about it, they're not expressing much disdain. Neither am I hearing Bill or Nancy denounce anything. The violence which might come someday from tea parties seems to trouble them more than the violence which has actually arrived. I'm not saying Arizonians have no right to protest a new law. Neither would I blame the high majority of the crowd for the actions of a few. But in offering that qualification, I am bestowing far more grace than the left gives the Tea Party movement. For in that case, the majority is being blamed not for the actions of some, but the actions of none. Hey, kids, need to learn your left from your right? Well, the right is the side that keeps being blamed for what the left did. And did you hear the latest? Now, San Francisco, the city of San Francisco, has officially discouraged travel to Arizona. I just hope Arizona reciprocates and stops sending tourists to the cable car district.
She must belong to San Francisco. She must have lost her way. Posting a poster of Poncho and Cisco one California day. She says she believes in a Robin Hood and brotherhood and colors of green and gray. And all you can do is laugh at her. Doesn't anybody know how to pray? Arizona, take off your rainbow shades. Arizona, have another look at the world like mine. Arizona, cut off your Indian braids. Arizona, hey, won't you go my way? Strip off your pride, you're acting like a teeny bopper runaway child. And scrape off the paint from the face of a little town saint. Arizona, take off your hobo shoes. Arizona, hey, won't you go my way? Francisco, I will be guide your way. I'll be the Count of Monte Cristo, you'll be the Countess May. You can believe in Robin Hood and Brotherhood and rolling the ball in the hay. I will be reading you an Aesop's fable, anything to make you stay. The world might mine. Arizona.
Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170, 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to our program. Well, Mother's Day is just around the corner. That means I have to send my mother a gift all the way to Israel. I just hope that if I send it tomorrow, it reaches her by Mother's Day. Well, KCBQ is making it a little easier for you. They're giving away a $50 gift certificate, well, several $50 gift certificates to Pro Flowers. Visit kcbq.com. Send us a special fun picture of the mother in your life doing something that shows their motherly, nurturing talents that brings a smile to your face and a pace in your step. Send us the picture today. Visit kcbq.com to enter, and you may win a $50 certificate. If you'd like to connect with us, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net, or call in toll-free, 1-888-344-1170. Now, I can't peg this to any one person because I've been asked this question by a bunch of my readers and listeners. Everybody's asking me this these days. Question goes like this. Bob, do you think Republicans will really take back the House and the Senate this fall, or are they getting too overconfident? Well, they probably are getting too overconfident. But actually, I do believe Republicans will regain Congress. Losing the November election is not my concern, but I am concerned. I'm far more troubled about what will happen after they win. You see, Obama will continue to paint them as the party of no. He'll keep pointing out the wonderful things he's trying to do for our country and how those stick-in-the-mud Republicans are a bunch of killjoys who don't believe in moving forward. The media will portray them in the exact same way. Indeed, Obama may have bailed out some major newspapers by then, which means they will be in his corner. Yeah, as if that wasn't happening already, but they'll really be in his corner even more after he bails them out. Remember when Time magazine called Newt the Gingrich, who stole Christmas? Newt Gingrich to this day still has that reputation. In any event, if the Republicans hold their ground in the face of these attacks, they'll be just fine. But if they start losing sleep over what the New York Times is going to write about them in the op-ed piece the next morning, we may start seeing more of that reaching across the aisle in a vain attempt to prove compassion and bipartisanship to a media and Democratic minority who will hate and demonize the Republicans no matter what they do. Hey, GOP, a word to the wise. Nothing you say, nothing you do will change the minds of those who hate you, so you may as well just do what's right. But I'm not holding my breath. These are my concerns. You see, Republicans are just great at standing their ground for conservative issues when they are out of power. When they actually rule, something in the Washington water changes them, and they use this same water to flush their success down the sewer. Next question. Writing in regard to last week's program, where right at the end of the show, I began a discussion, which I promised to continue, about forgiving only those who ask for forgiveness. Most people are under the impression that Christians are to forgive everybody, whether they ask for forgiveness or not. Well, latching on to that idea, Diane in El Cajon writes, "Hi, Bob. Here's a question that might fit into next week's show. You may forgive someone but not forget, correct? A friend of mine said he is not a Christian. If someone close to you keeps doing something that you think and feel shows no respect for you, but keeps saying, sorry, give me a chance to repent, and you say, I can forgive you because I do not want to carry hate in my heart, but I will not forget, then I end the relationship. I feel that is still being a Christian. Am I right? Remember the Gomer Pyle show when he used to say, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Well, he had it right. Very clear and simple. Keep up the great show, Diana. Well, Diana, I'm happy that you call me a great show in the company of other great shows like Gomer Pyle. That's a very good question that you're asking, Diana. But actually, I remember Scotty on Star Trek saying that, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. But who knows, Gomer might have said it too. It's probably an old saying that predates television by many years. But Diana, I'm going to go ahead and continue the discussion that I started last week, and that should help with your question. I had referred to Luke chapter 17, where Jesus says, if your brother sins, rebuke him. If he repents, forgive him. So would not the reverse also be true? If he does not repent, do not forgive him. This very interesting passage in Luke 17 makes even more sense when we remember that God is our example here. Does God forgive everyone? Now, I know that as Christians, we want to rush in and say, well, yes, of course. And you are correct in a sense, in as much as forgiveness is promised by God and commanded of Christians. But God not only authored those words, he went on to teach us what he meant by them. Here's a question. Will everybody be in heaven? Now, this is according to the teaching of the New Testament. You may not believe in the New Testament, and I respect that. I will not go on a jihad against you if you don't believe in the New Testament. You can believe whatever you want. But I'm posing this question out to the Christians in the audience, to those who accept the infallibility, the inspiration of the New Testament. According to the New Testament, will everybody be in heaven? No. According to the New Testament, only those who turn from their sin, or more specifically, only those who accept God's forgiveness will be in heaven. The person in hell for all of eternity does not feel forgiven, and in point of fact, is not forgiven. Yes, he could have been forgiven. Yes, God wanted to forgive him. Yes, Jesus died for his sins, but not all sins. The sin of rejecting God's forgiveness was not paid for. In similar manner, our friends or families are forgiven by us when they ask for forgiveness. My dad disowned me for becoming a Christian. Any anger held toward my dad was eventually dealt with, and I did have a genuine desire to forgive him. I could even picture in my mind what it would be like, but my dad never asked my forgiveness and passed away separated from his son. My mother is still alive. She had gone along with Dad's decision to disown me because she was afraid to confront him. After Dad passed away, my mother expressed regret over all that went on over the years. It has been a joy and privilege to forgive my mother. And in her case, she was able to experience my forgiveness because she wanted forgiveness. Now, so far, it has been helpful to compare the healing of a human relationship to the healing of a God-human relationship. But there's also an important difference. God alone has a right to offer forgiveness to all who will receive it because all have sinned against God. It's not the same with me. Not all humans have sinned against me. Only some have. It's not incumbent upon me to forgive somebody for what they did to a third party. That, quite simply, is none of my business. Oh, sure, I could tell this person that God forgives them, but if they have wronged another individual, the two of them must settle things themselves. Oftentimes, when some murderer is on death row, I'll listen to Christians call into the radio talk shows saying that we must forgive the man. Well, excuse me, but the only individuals in a position to forgive are the families of the victims. And in those cases, whether or not they extend forgiveness depends upon whether or not the murderer has owned up to what he has done and whether or not the murderer has asked for forgiveness. Should they forgive him if he repents? Yes. Should they harbor bitterness in their hearts if he does not repent? No. Nevertheless, if the murderer has not asked the family to forgive what he did to their loved one, they have not forgiven him, neither should they be encouraged to do so. We'll return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Thank you.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric. Back to our program. Are Christians commanded to forgive everybody? Well, Jesus said, a person who repents, we forgive. And I was explaining that that's the same way it works with God. God says, I forgive everybody. I became a man at a certain time in history. And in 33 AD, I died on the cross to forgive everybody. But when God says he forgives everybody, what he really means is he potentially forgives everybody. The cross made the forgiveness legal and possible. The cross was God's justice and mercy combined, because justice said that our sins had to be paid for. And when the Bible talks about sin, they mean selfishness. Our selfishness, where we put ourselves above others, that had to be paid for. But God is so loving and so merciful, he doesn't want you to have to pay for it. I've said this many times in this program. Let me say it again. If you had been the only person in this world, God would have become a man and died just for you. He was actually thinking about you on that cross. That's how much he loves you. But God's a gentleman. He doesn't force himself upon people. I know that sometimes tactless evangelists force themselves upon people. They are doing that in disobedience to God. When people were following Jesus around, whenever Jesus' message got a little bit too difficult, the crowds who loved it when he was feeding them and doing miracles, when it was a fun show, crowd got bigger. When he started challenging them to really give their lives over to God, even to the point of being willing to die for God, the crowd got thin. And Jesus never chased out of after them. He never said, hey, we're going to have punch and cookies. We're going to have a special concert tonight. Come on, it's going to be a blast. He didn't do that. He just turned to his disciples and he said, anybody else want to go? God is a gentleman. He does not force himself. So if a person rejects God's forgiveness, if they reject Christ, they will not be in heaven. You know, it's interesting today. A lot of people tell me, I can't believe that a loving God would send somebody to hell. Good question to always ask. Do you believe a loving God would send people to heaven? And people will always say yes. And then we say, well, who's going to be in heaven? Well, everybody. Everybody? Adolf Hitler's going to be in heaven. Idi Amin's going to be in heaven. Saddam Hussein's going to be in heaven. Ahmadinejad, when he kicks off, he's going to be in heaven. That's not going to be much of a heaven, is it? Well, of course, those are obvious extreme examples. But if we all look at our hearts, we realize that we have a good side, but we have a sinful side. So for God to let anybody in heaven, it kind of pollutes heaven. If there were any evil in heaven, then heaven would start becoming hell. And we start realizing that a loving God is going to separate it out. He's going to put good people in heaven. He's going to put bad people in hell. But then the Bible adds a little twist and says none of us are good. And that's where Jesus comes in. Because of what he did on the cross, God can change us and transform us, even to the point where the Bible calls it being born again. And that's what must happen before anybody could enter the kingdom of heaven. But God will not force that process upon you. So those who reject God are rejecting his forgiveness. The irony is God was willing to forgive them, but if they don't experience the forgiveness, if they don't accept the forgiveness, they're not forgiven. Now, likewise, when Muslims go around with signs claiming the Holocaust never happened, or rulers like Ahmadinejad brag about how they're going to sponsor a new Holocaust and wipe Israel off the face of the map, sometimes Christians rush in like cute little puppy dogs saying, well, we've got to forgive them. That is a gross misrepresentation of justice when Christians too quickly offer forgiveness. Let the Jews decide for themselves if they wish to forgive some Holocaust denier or instigator. Christians may forgive those who speak and fight against Christians. In other words, we mind our own business. Even so, in Revelation chapter 19, we see the glimpse into the future, Christians rejoicing over the destruction of those who murdered God's servants, people who chose not to repent and to continue with their evil. True, I would love to see everybody turn from sin someday, but many will not. And nevertheless, I can celebrate when a wicked man dies, if he's an unrepentant wicked man. I can celebrate when he dies only because he's no longer going to be able to hurt anybody and because justice has finally been done. I not only care about him and his repentance, I care about the people he's hurting. If he's not going to turn, then I care about the victims more than him at that point. Yes, he could have known mercy. But if he rejects mercy, I'm still grateful to see justice. So let's sum this all up. Speaking out against evil does not mean we are unwilling to forgive evil, but speaking out against evil and working to stop evil are also part of the gospel. We are to forgive sin when the sinner asks for forgiveness. This is the way God handles it. Finally, even if one does not ask for forgiveness, we are to potentially forgive them and at least carry forgiveness in our hearts rather than bitterness, because bitterness will destroy you. Now, I know that for many of my Christian brothers and sisters listening right now, this was a whole new way of looking at things. I'm just going to ask you to open your minds, consider what I'm saying, and bottom line, if you do not feel I'm being biblical, you go with the Bible. If I should turn out to be wrong, heck, just forgive me. You have to forgive me. You're a Christian. Now, getting back to the question that Diana asked, in her case, she's talking about somebody that does ask for forgiveness but keeps doing the same thing. Well, I just remind you, Diana, that verse that we looked at in Luke that we started with, Jesus didn't merely say that they asked for forgiveness. He says they repented. Truly asking for forgiveness is saying, God, I'm sorry, and God, I'm not going to do it. Now, do we sometimes have repeat offenders? Of course. But if people are continuing to do the same thing so often that it's like walking through one of those revolving doors to get into a store or a bank, well, then they're just playing games with God. So if this is somebody who's not truly repenting, then I would agree with you, no matter how many times he or she says, please forgive me. At that point, you just say, look, I forgive you, but I there's something going on between you and God, and I've got to be free to move on, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I don't know the details of your situation, Diana, but whatever they are, I hope that was helpful. Now, let's get back to the question that we threw out at the top of the show, and this one came to me last week. Bob, the Old Testament talks about unicorns in many places. Now, everybody knows what a unicororn is. It's that horse with the horn on his head. And Bob, since this is a mythological animal, doesn't its mention in the Bible support the atheist claim and the skeptical claim that the Bible is nothing but a collection of myths? Okay, let's clear this up. Unicorn, the English translation, the word unicorn, is a King James mistranslation of the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word was reem. The word more correctly translates as wild ox, and many of our English translations translate it exactly that way. Compare the following two verses, first from the King James and then from the NIV translation. I'm reading from Deuteronomy 33:17. It says, his glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horns are like the horns of unicorns. That's King James. Now, same verse in the New International Version, Deuteronomy 33:17 again. In majesty, he is like a firstborn bull. His horns are like the horns of a wild ox. Now, notice that in both versions, even though one calls it wild ox and the other calls it unicorns, both versions, the horns are described in the plural. All right? There's more than one horn. So we cannot possibly be talking about a one-horned unicorn. That settles it, no matter how you translate the word. Now, having said that, I always like to give a little bit of latitude. Even if the translations were disputed, supposing a creature with only one horn was described in the Bible, there's nothing particularly unusual about that. The rhinoceros, after all, has only one horn. Could there have once been unicorns which existed in biblical days and are now extinct? Of course. How exactly would this prove the Bible to be mythology? An extinct animal is not the same as an imaginary animal. Now, I know that in some mythology, unicorns fly, but we don't hear about flying unicorns in the Bible. Would we dismiss literature which mentioned the dodo bird just because the dodo bird no longer exists? In any event, with or without unicorns, the bigger reason, the far bigger reason that atheists assume the Bible to be mythology would be the numerous miraculous accounts. And so to be thorough, let's address that question as well. In a scientific age, can I accept miracles? Let's talk first about the miracle of the resurrection. That's the most important miracle in the Bible. We'll use that one as an example. If the same number of eyewitnesses and historians who recorded the resurrection merely reported that a man named Jesus had started a revolution in 33 AD, no one would doubt it. The incredible miracles associated with the resurrection understandably create tougher standards and greater skepticism, but are such special criteria fair, or do they instead close our minds to the witness of history? Think about it. If you are going to start by assuming that miracles are impossible, it will never matter to you how much evidence can be brought forth, because all data will be immediately dismissed. An open mind ought not to assume that miracles are impossible. After all, when the Bible talks of miracles, it's not assuming that God waved his hands like a magician and threw natural law out the window. God, as the author of life, is also the author of all scientific law. If science has taught us one lesson over the years, it's that humankind frequently learns to do things previous generations would have thought impossible. Imagine somebody in 70 AD looking at a television set, or a telephone, or a computer. Imagine them looking at the images dancing around on the screen of your cell phone. Imagine their expressions if they could watch a rocket blast off and land on the moon, or if they could see a jet touch down on a runway. To them, such technology would appear very miraculous. Now, obviously to us, these are not miracles, but rather a harnessing of scientific knowledge previous generations had not yet discovered. Likewise, it's easy to assume that human beings, 1,000 years in the future, or even 100 years in the future, when we see how fast recent technology has developed, will be able to do things which would absolutely baffle our minds. If it's so easy to believe that people will be able to do that someday, why is it so hard to imagine that God, if he exists, can do these things now? A true open mind will not assume that miracles are impossible, because the testimony of science has actually provided evidence to the contrary. Miracle is just a descriptive word for something science currently cannot explain. Therefore, the resurrection or any other event in the Bible should be examined with the same test we would use for any other historical event. And that's why I don't believe the Bible to be mythology. Well, comments sent to me directly are one thing. These days, there are also comments written about me. This is because some of my debates and other videos are now easily accessible on YouTube. For example, a few years ago, the 700 Club did a documentary about my testimony, how I became a Christian. They were particularly interested in my Jewish background and subsequent conversion to Christianity. Well, the video has developed a life of its own on YouTube. Needless to say, this has spawned a plethora of comments from fellow Jews, far too many to read over the air, but I'm going to read a few of them today because they're very interesting. One of them, I'll tell you when we get back. I think one of them's anti-Semitic, the others are arrogant, but we're going to have fun with them when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Projects don't just happen. Good projects are a result of a team of dedicated professionals, owners, architects, and contractors striving toward a common goal. Make OMP a part of your team. If you're looking for professional, knowledgeable experience for your construction project team, Oso Miller Pacific should be your first call. For over 20 years, Mark Miller has been providing project management and constructive services throughout San Diego and Southern California. As president of Oso Miller Pacific, Mark continues this tradition of providing the most professional services in the industry to the healthcare, commercial, and government construction markets. Oso Miller Pacific provides a full range of pre-construction services, including definition of needs, design team selection, concept budget generation, and construction services. This full range of services is what sets Oso Miller Pacific apart from its competition. Visit their website at osomillerpacific.com. That's www.osomillerpacific.com or call the offices at 619-449-0633. Again, the number is 619-449-0633. Good projects don't just happen. Call Oso Miller Pacific. Welcome back to our program. I mentioned right before we went to the break that a few years ago, the 700 Club did a story about my testimony. They were interested in me converting to Christianity out of a Jewish background. Now, even though they aired that on TV a number of years ago, these days videos never die. They develop a new life on the internet. This has been posted by several sources and can be found all over YouTube, and it's gotten thousands of hits. And there are places for people to make comments. Some of these comments are coming from Jews. Some of these comments are not coming from Jews. Now, just to show you my objectivity, early in the program, you heard me just ripping into Cardinal Mahoney of the Catholic Church for comparing what's going on in Arizona to the Holocaust, only because it lightens the Holocaust. You've heard me speak a lot on this show in defense of Israel, speaking out against historical revision, speaking against anti-Semitism. And obviously, as one who has Jewish blood, who has a Jewish background, Jewish father, Jewish mother, Jewish heritage, obviously this is very emotional for me. But that doesn't mean that I'm some unobjective person who always takes the side of the Jews no matter what. For example, many of the Jews who listen to this show and appreciate what I say about Israel probably have some difficulty when they hear me defend Christianity and say that I, as a Jew, don't feel it contradicts my Judaism to accept Jesus as the Messiah. Those are fighting words to some Jews. And I want to start by saying, because I'm going to be very critical of some of these emails that I read, but I want to start by saying that I understand why most Jews reject Jesus. I had the same reasons when I used to reject him. The idea of God becoming a man is pretty difficult to swallow, and that's the main problem that they have. They don't believe Jesus was the Messiah because they thought the Messiah would bring peace to the earth. And actually, in Jesus' second coming, he's going to do that. But he didn't do it the first time. That's confusing to the Jews. But far more of a problem to them is the idea of God incarnating himself and taking human form. Now, actually, if they just read their own holy scriptures, they'd see chapters like Genesis 18, where Abraham is talking to a man, and this man is talking as if he's God, and Abraham gets down and bows down before him. This is what we would have called a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. No, he didn't use the word Jesus, but the idea of God taking on the form of a man is an Old Testament idea too. When we say that Jesus was God, we're not saying we made some man into God. We're saying that God, if he wanted to take on human form, could do so. Jesus existed in the form of God, the God of Israel, not only the God of Israel, the God of the universe. Now, these fellows who write the little critiques, they always use nicknames. This nickname is Goatee. And he says, regarding my testimony, a horribly sad story, but typical of the American Jewish experience. His parents rejected Hashem and Torah, and as a result, another Jew lost to Christianity, which worships a demagogue. Now, all right, I mentioned a moment ago that I can appreciate where a lot of Jews are coming from. That's one thing. If you don't believe in Christianity, if you have trouble believing God could become a man, that's up to you. I don't blame you at all for feeling that way. When I see downright arrogance, though, and presumption, then I feel a little differently. And I need to respond to your statement, Goatee. It's true that my parents rejected the Torah. Torah means the first five books of the Bible, for those of you unfamiliar with that word. It's true that my parents rejected the Torah. It's true that I was raised as an atheist. So I came out of a very liberal Jewish family. But Goatee, as kindly as I can put it, it's not true that you know or understand anything about my conversion because, frankly, you weren't there. I had an experience with the Spirit of God. Do you know what the Spirit of God is, Goatee? You should, because he's talked about quite a bit in the Torah, in places where it says the Spirit of God came upon Moses, for example. Now, I may not have grown up reading the Torah, but I read it now. and is one who reads the Torah and the New Testament. The God of the Torah and the God of the New Testament are one and the same God. They are not a demigod. This next fellow calls himself Age of Universal Deceit. Now, this guy is not Jewish. And but look at what he says. Jesus was a poor child, so he definitely was not a Jew, because Jews of that time were already extremely wealthy. Wait, can you just see the anti-Semitism here? Now, maybe this guy doesn't feel he's an anti-Semite. Maybe I'm being unfair. If you're listening, Universal Deceit, and I think your name is well spoken, but if you're listening, you want to come on my show and tell me that you're not anti-Semitic? Fine, but all the flags of anti-Semitism are here. And notice the Jews were already wealthy, which means Jews are wealthy people. That's such a stereotype. I'm Jewish. I'm not wealthy. I'm in debt up to my ears right now. I am not wealthy. I have never been wealthy. And but he's talking about the fact that the Jews in Jesus' day were all wealthy. He says, all Jew children, no, he doesn't say Jewish children, all Jew children of that time were taught to read and write, while the children of the poor never learned how to read and write, which is why Jesus never wrote anything down. All the words attributed to Jesus in the New Testament would only be about a 45-minute speech. So obviously the Jews took the words of the non-Jew Jesus and twisted them for their own purposes of psych warfare. What liars. Okay, so Jews are liars. Yeah, it's true that the words attributed to Jesus in the New Testament were written by his followers. That doesn't mean Jesus didn't know how to write. In fact, we have an example in the New Testament of Jesus writing. When he rescued the woman caught in adultery, he got down in the sand and he wrote things, probably the names of the sins of the people standing in the crowd, so that he could say to them, let you who are without sin cast the first stone. Well, I'll continue answering this extremely anti-Semitic and ignorant comment, which ignorance is matched only by its arrogance, when we return to Bob Segal, the Jewish Christian who doesn't serve a demigod, but the real God.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Segal Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsegal.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsegal.net. BobSegal.net.
This is Bob Segal inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show, Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com. Welcome back to our program. I'm reading a letter which, if this guy's not an anti-Semite, he does a good impersonation. He calls himself Age of Universal Deceit. He's talking about the deceit of the Jews. All Jews are liars. All Jews are rich. All Jews in Jesus' day were rich. And the words attributed to Jesus were made up by the Jews. Now, I've just got to ask you, my friend, the Jews living under Roman conquest were all wealthy? Under Roman conquest, and they were all wealthy. Where are you getting your facts? Certainly not from history. There were Jewish poor people. There were Jewish slaves. Jesus wasn't a Jew because he was poor. You could be poor and be a Jew. Jesus wasn't a Jew. The Jews took his words and twisted them. You know this. How exactly? There is not one written document from this time that even remotely resembles what you're saying, not just including the New Testament, but the writings of Josephus the historian, the writings of the Roman historian Tacitus, who also talked about Jesus. They would not agree with you. They all claim that he was a Jew, and usually those who try to deny Jesus's Jewishness are anti-Semitic. anti-Semites. Now, this next one is written by a fellow who's not an anti-Semite because he is Jewish. His name is Nilhav. And Nilhav is talking about my testimony. But again, I'm seeing some arrogance here. Always the ignorant Jew that is pulled in by the false prophet. Deuteronomy 13 warns us against this, even when spiritual experiences support it. Practically all Messianic Jews come from Tanakh ignorant backgrounds. Well, actually, Nilhav, I've found that all kinds of Jews today are ignorant of the Tanakh, Tanakh meaning the scriptures. I particularly find such ignorance when they're unaware of the many prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. For example, the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, 700 years before Jesus was born, Isaiah the prophet predicted that the Messiah would die for Israel's sin and then rise from the dead. Other prophecies about the Messiah described a warrior who would deliver Israel from her enemies and then rule as king. That would be the Zechariah 14 passage. This alternate understanding of the Messiah became the more popular one. It is the type of Messiah Jews expected in Jesus' day, which explains why he was rejected and explains why Jews today have so much difficulty seeing Jesus as their Messiah. But there had been a time when the Messiah was expected to suffer for our sins before ruling as king. Here are some highlights from Isaiah 53. And remember, again, this is written 700 years before Jesus lived. Isaiah says, "Surely he took our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was put upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shears is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away." Okay, however, the Messiah would not only suffer. In this same chapter of Isaiah, we're told that the Messiah would die, for he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. But it gets even better. In this same chapter, after this death, the Messiah will live again and rule, starting with verse 10. "Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied." See, he's alive again. "By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life into death and was numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors." If that doesn't describe Jesus, who on earth does it describe? Now, here's a question. But Bob, if this prophecy is that obvious, why don't more people become Christians, especially Jews? Well, a lot of Jews don't actually believe in the Old Testament. There are a couple of standard objections to this passage. One of them is says, well, the original words of Isaiah did not contain these words. They were changed by the church to make it look like a fulfilled prophecy. Oh, really? Let me tell you something, my friends. The transmission of the Hebrew Old Testament text remained in the hands of the Jews, not the Christians. I've seen translations of this passage that the church never touched with a 10-foot pole. Even more compelling, the Dead Sea Scroll findings in 1947 produced another complete copy of the book of Isaiah. The date for this text is around 150 BC. Are we also going to claim Christians tampered with that? But there's another reason why people claim that this is not referring to Jesus, and I'll get into those reasons next week. This is Bob Siegel, just making the obvious obvious.